This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Coleman Andrews is considered one of America's foremost food writers. He's the author of more than 25,000 articles and 8 books. At the heart of Coleman Andrews' philosophy of food writing is that it requires a point of view. The best example is his Saveur magazine, which he founded in 1994. That magazine is credited with putting recipes in historical and cultural context. He's in the Triangle this weekend, going to be reading and signing books at McIntyre's Fine Books in Farrington Village this Sunday. But first, he joins me from a studio in New York City. Coleman Andrews, welcome back to the State of Things.
No, thanks very much.
Also, our favorite foodie, Kelly Alexander, with us in the studio. She has been an editor at Saveur with Coleman and is author of Hometown Appetites, the story of Clementine Paddleford, the forgotten food writer who chronicled how America ate. Hello, Kelly.
Hi.
Coleman, let's start with you. And I actually want to go back to the beginning because we were having this conversation as this segment came together and we were talking about food and how it all got started. And the question really was, why aren't we just grabbing fruit off the tree and turning over rocks and eating grubs? It was working for a while. I mean, when did we start, you know, so the whole idea of raising cattle and cooking food, and not so much horticulture and agriculture, but cooking as well?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously no one knows what went on in prehistory, but I like to think that there was some guy who said, hey, you know, if you pull this leaf off the tree and eat it with this berry, it probably tastes better than that leaf does. I think we are blessed with a pretty sophisticated taste system involving our olfactory and system in our taste buds. And I think, you know, people naturally react to things that go together better, that taste better than other things. So I think they're probably, of course, part of the when people started eating by foraging and, you know, finding what they could, obviously they learned quickly which things they shouldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you had to sacrifice a few members of the tribe in order to do that. But things that were bitter, things that were that foamed, things like that, they probably avoided because after a while they learned that those were probably not going to be good. You know, as far as when the first chefs or the first, I won't say chefs, but cooks that really took trouble with food, I think it probably did come after the domestication of crops and animals, because when you had to just go out and hope you found something to eat, or hope that your spear or arrow found the right animal, you didn't worry too much about the fine points. You were starving, you ate what you could find. Mm. Once there was a regular source of food, then I think people probably started to say, let's make it taste better by doing this to it, or, you know, that way of cooking doesn't work as well as this way of cooking.
I guess, and Kelly, that would lead us to the open fire, right? The idea that we have to
right.
warm it.
Well,
or char it.
So when you say the beginning, I mean, if you want to talk about fire, you're really going to the beginning.
We're going all the way back.
Right. And so it has actual an important local through line there, because
North Carolinians invented fire.
North Carolinians.
It was invented here.
North Carolinians are part of a long tradition of people who like to cook food over fire for a long time, slowly, and only we call it barbecue now, mm-hmm. and who knows what they called it at the beginning of time. But they were definitely doing it then, and we know that, despite what any raw food enthusiast might say, as long as there was food and there was fire, they were going on together, right?
Yeah.
And so when I – this is a special day for me, because Coleman is really – he was my editor, but he was, as much as anything, my teacher. And I have a group of my students who take a food writing class with me at Duke behind me in the control room now. One of the things we talk about in my class a lot is the birth of cuisine. And so naturally we talk a lot about France, and inevitably the conversation turns to, do we have anything like that in America? And I immediately point to barbecue, which is what we have, mm-hmm. and which comes from those days of man and fire.
But it does.
You know, some,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say quickly something that people, when they talk about, obviously the discovery of how to harness fire was tremendously important. Another thing, though, in the development of cooking was the development of watertight vessels, of pottery or woven grass vessels or whatever. Grass probably not as good because it would burn. But when pottery became available, when we figured out sometime in the Neolithic era, probably 10,000 BC, something like that, how to make pots that would hold liquid or hold foods, that really greatly expanded the possibility of what you could cook.
And, of course, all of this becomes a kind of a game of leapfrog because as you become more inventive and ingenious about the tools and the ways of storing food and cooking food, it tends to then favor a kind of thinking and ingenuity. And so evolution itself is in many ways tied to the whole concept of cooking and preserving food. All of that's good. Now, here's my question, though. Here's my prickly barb that I will toss into the mix here. And that is, has it gotten a bit too precious? Is it more than about, I mean, when it gets well beyond sustenance, is this some sort of middle class preoccupation that has taken us from appreciation to fetish? I'll put it to you first, Coleman.
Well, I think in any field, if you talk about where we live, about shelter, we don't need much more from shelter than, you know, a roof and walls, and maybe we want some privacy and some way of heating the place in the cold weather, something like that. But why do we take the trouble to worry about decor? Why do we put paintings on the wall or posters on the wall? Why do we buy this couch and not that couch or paint the wall this color and not that color? It all has to do with improving our environment, of pleasing ourselves. And I think the elaboration of cooking is very similar. We don't have to do everything that we do. We can live very simply. We can eat very simply, and many people do, either out of choice or not, around the world. But when you have the capability to do this, then people, it's human nature to look at something and say, how can we elaborate it? How can we make it better? How can we take more enjoyment out of it?
Well, Kelly,
I think it's natural.
How do you teach people to think about food?
A.J. Liebling once said that to be a good writer on food, you have to have a good appetite. And I totally agree with the sentiment there. I mean, to think about food, you need to do one thing, which is to be a good eater. So the people who aren't that can probably leave the room, right? Mm-hmm. And that leaves a whole bunch of other people. So what I really try to encourage people to do when they think about food is realize that it's never really food that we're talking about. It's the great, I mean, food's like the greatest gateway drug ever for conversations about race and class and economics and love and all those really important life themes. And it all starts there for me, and I think for a lot of other people too.
Right. And of course, people do distinguish themselves religiously and culturally and so forth by what they eat or don't eat. It becomes a part of their identity.
Well, you know, Coleman, you gave a speech once called On Authenticity. In Oxford, England. What do you mean by authenticity when it comes to food?
That is a really tough question.
But you gave a speech on it.
I did, in which I basically said, "Who knows?" There's a school of thought which I can't completely disregard, which says that you cannot cook an authentic dish from another culture unless you're part of that culture. I mean, then it wouldn't be another culture. That if we go to let's take something like bouillabaisse, okay, springs into my mind. And if you cook bouillabaisse, according to what the people in Marseille, where it was probably invented, will tell you, you need two or three certain varieties of fish that have to be in that pot, and you have to cook it in a certain way. Now, this was a dish that was born as a poor fisherman's dish. They took the varieties of fish that they couldn't sell at the market because they were too bony. Now, that happened to make them very flavorful for a broth. But if we go to the trouble of buying, if we could even find them, those exact same three fish because we want to make, quote-unquote, an authentic bouillabaisse, we may have the authentic ingredients, but we are violating the spirit of the dish, which is basically take the cheap stuff and throw it in a pot.
And that's true of a lot of stews and sausages. Somebody saying, oh, no, that's not the way we do it in Chicago. Well, there's every neighborhood, every family made their own whatever.
Absolutely.
Pasta sauce. They made their own brand of Italian sausage.
Absolutely.
The concept that there's some one authentic blend is kind of crazy.
Yeah, there's a canon for French cuisine, and maybe to an extent there have been books on Italian or Chinese cuisine, a few other cuisines around the world. But basically there's no canonical ordinary cooking. There's no one authentic, absolutely right dish.
Yeah, reminds me of when I went on the quest for authentic bacala, the way my grandmother used to make it, and I found out that what I had to do was buy salt cod. which meant a preserved cod, and then
unpreserve it,
and then unpreserve it, and then cook it the way my grandma did. And I thought, you know, I can get fresh cod. This is silly. Uh-huh. So, so I gave up the quest for authentic bacalao. Kelly, you've been working with some chefs and cooks on their books, like Myron Mixon, a book called Smokin'. Is that working with chefs to kind of craft a book? Is that its own art?
I hate to really generalize, and now I'm really going to. Mm-hmm. So the deal is that what a chef is now versus what a chef was. Coleman talked briefly about when food started getting really serious and codified, and recipes were written and
bacalaoified.
When it began as cuisine, chefs were guys who worked in really horribly asbestos-ridden basements, and they died at really young ages, and they didn't have teeth, and that's true. And now chefs are famous people, right? And the change between A and B has been tremendous, but the need for recipes is the same, if not greater, right? Because who are we going to learn to cook from now that we aren't passing recipes down from mother to daughter that way anymore? And so working with chefs is really, on the one hand, a lot of fun. It's also really can be very challenging. A lot of chefs can tell you how to make dinner for 200, but they can't tell you how to make dinner for 8. Mm. So translating that kind of stuff is rewarding and challenging. With somebody, the example you gave, Myron Mixon, who cooks barbecue and his life is devoted to driving around the country to win money in barbecue contests, it's really fun. Because he's got a real definite voice. He has a real spot he's coming from. He was born and raised in Middle Georgia in a town called Unadilla. And that is, no matter how many people watch him cook barbecue on TLC, his great genius is he's still that dude from Unadilla who's going to drive 1,000 miles to win $300 making a brisket.
Which is your point, and has been, I think, the aesthetic of your work, the body of work, Coleman, that it's as much the story as the recipe, whether it's the story of the chef or the story of the cuisine itself.
I mean, I can't prove it, but I suspect that if you know something about the origins of a dish and who invented it and why or what context it came out of, I'm pretty sure, well, I know you'll enjoy the dish more, but I'm pretty sure you can cook it better too. I can't prove that, but that's my suspicion.
So, Coleman, you know, a fair number of people are aware of your work as a food writer, but you also won a Grammy for the liner notes you wrote for a reissue of a Miles Davis album.
I didn't win the Grammy. I was nominated, unfortunately. I lost to Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
Well, that I can understand. That I can understand. I mean, who beat Sam the Sham
exactly.
and the Pharaohs?
Pharaoh. Exactly.
Woolly Bully. Was that the year?
That was it, yeah.
Oh, man. What, there were liner notes to Woolly Bully? What? Anyway.
Well, Sam Samudia, who was the Sam, wrote very, very nice liner notes about his background, where he came from, and so forth, and trumped me.
A lot better than the music. So here's the thing, though. But what about that kind of writing? Because you wrote for Cream Magazine. You were
a music
writer. Lester Bangs was your editor. Does that experience in any way, writing music, liner notes and, writing for music magazines, does that inform your writing as a food writer?
Well, I always tell people when I teach food writing classes or courses, I say, you know, there's really no such thing as a food writer. You're a writer, and you know how to write, or you don't, and you need to hone your craft and get to be able to express things in words and have the effect you want to on your readers. And then it doesn't matter if you're writing about football or food or music or politics or anything else.
Kelly?
So I don't think it's a separate discipline.
No, I would say that's actually the most valuable thing I learned working at Saveur, is that what's important in being a good food writer is just being a good writer. Coleman's particular genius is that he knows a lot of things about a lot of different subjects, music and European history and all those sorts of things. And when you can bring other knowledge into the subject of food, you've made it experiential. You've made it a bazillion times more interesting than someone who's taken pictures of a chocolate cake on their iPhone. And I don't mean that to be derogatory. I mean it to say that, like all good writing, if you know something about something, it's better.
Yeah, but talking about new technology, let's talk about some transitional technology, TV. You guys came of age here and began writing when there was no Food Network. What's been the impact of the explosion of this kind of the popularity of these kind of programs on food writing? For better, for worse, got more people interested on the one hand. On the other hand, the literature is maybe leaner. What do you think, Coleman?
Well, I think the Food Network and other food programs have tremendously changed the way people think about chefs, the way people think about food, not necessarily for the better. I don't know that they've affected food writing. I think what's affected food writing is the internet, is the open forum, the fact that anyone can express his or her opinions about food and offer photographs and you know, critiques, and the idea of the expert, of the well-traveled the guy or the woman who's eaten lots of stuff or had lots of wines or whatever and learned about them and has a context and so forth, that's greatly devalued now. And what's valued more is what your buddy thinks or what your buddy's buddy thinks, as expressed on Yelp or somewhere else.
Kelly?
That's changed more than...
Yeah.
No, I think Coleman is right to make a distinction. I think the way that we learn how to cook has been affected by television, at first positively, because you're talking about 1961 and Julia Child and the original episodes of The French Chef on WGBH. And that was sort of the beginning of food on television. But now food on television, you can't learn how to boil an egg. What you can do is watch somebody get voted off the island or whatever, right? So that's how we're learning about food, is the channels to learn how to cook anything are getting smaller. But I think Coleman's absolutely right on the other hand about the way that people are expressing it. TV hasn't affected food writing. The internet has affected food writing, right? So,
but so what's wrong with that? So my buddy, who I know and whose taste I appreciate and understand, says don't eat there and don't eat this. Isn't that more important than what Coleman Andrews thinks?
I think that's great if it were that simple, but it's not that simple. If I go on a website and look up a restaurant, I'm coming to a city I don't know and I want to find out where to eat. I look up some of the famous restaurants in that town, and I see on Yelp or a similar site, I see 100 reviews of it, ranging from this place is the pits, I would never set foot in here again, to best meal we've ever had in our lives. Who do I know? It's not my friend. I mean, I don't know these people personally. Or maybe I do know four of them and they disagree. It doesn't do me any good. Yeah. I don't know who to believe.
And you don't need to go to your friend's blog. You could just ask them. But go ahead. Yeah, Kelly.
Exactly,
what it's so useful for in so many ways, that kind of stuff, is I find as a food writer, people automatically think I spend a lot of time writing about restaurants. I spend very little time writing about restaurants. I used to do it more, but I do it less and less. And when people ask me, do you like to go to so-and-so, or what are your favorite restaurants, before I can even answer, 9 times out of 10, what the person who's asking really wants to do is tell me what they think of that restaurant, right? Is get it off their chest because they didn't give them enough water, or they gave them too much water, or whatever. And so those forums are great for that, and they're great for sharing those kinds of experiences. That, to me, has almost nothing to do with what I do for a living.
So what do you like to eat in North Carolina? Kelly, I'll start with you.
The Mexican food boom here in the Triangle is amazing. So I'm always looking for really great Mexican, and we can find it. So that's where I'm at right now.
Coleman?
Yeah, well, I would have to say the same thing. I mean, thanks to Kelly, I discovered the Mexican food boom about 3 years ago and wrote about it for Gourmet, which was still publishing in those days, and I was astonished. I'm from Southern California. I've spent a lot of time in Texas. I'm a big fan of Mexican food and its Americanized versions, and I just thought there was wonderful, wonderful Mexican food around Durham and elsewhere. Of course, I love barbecue, and I think there's a lot of other very good food in that area. Andrea Rusing's restaurant, The Lantern, for instance, which is Asian, sort of, I won't say fusion, sort of pan-Asian or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, it's a really good place to eat, and there's wonderful produce too, of course. Aren't much, but...
No, but the produce is spectacular, even when you overcook it, and that's the good thing. You can cook those greens to death, and they're still great.
Sure,
Thank you both for being on the program. Coleman Andrews,
thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Kelly Alexander, thank you too.
Thank you.
Coleman Andrews' newest book is called The Country Cooking of Italy. He's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Farrington Village this Sunday at 5 o'clock. Kelly Alexander joins us regularly to talk about food and the culture of food. Her latest book is Smokin' with Myron Mixon. Coming up next, the music of Jeff Hart. Stay tuned to The State of Things.
Italy, not sure I should see you anymore.